In our study tonight, we're going to pretty well pick up with Genesis chapter 12. We're not going to spend as much time, perhaps, as I otherwise would on that portion of the text, but I do want to reiterate a thing or two from that because it becomes foundational, really, for the next, the rest of our study. As we're talking about history and geography of the Bible, the development of the scheme of saving man, God's plan to save man. And as we turn to Genesis chapter 12, I simply want to reiterate the promises that are made in this text. Some of you that were a part of our Thursday evening authority class expressed interest in studying the scheme of redemption, and this becomes the backbone of that study as well. Though our focus in this class is going to be somewhat different, we can't help but note the things that make these places so well known. When God made the promise unto Abraham, in Genesis chapter 11 and chapter 12, we're reading of Abraham being having removed from Ur of Chaldee and come to Haran. And God had told Abraham to get thee up out of thy country and from thy kindred, verse 1, and from thy father's house unto the land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and be thou a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and him that curseth thee will I curse. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now the remainder of this chapter, we're going to see that Abraham settles in the land of Canaan, in the place of Shechem, near the oak of Moreh. We're going to talk about that in some detail in just a little bit, but I want to note just here where Abraham has come from. He's come from Ur of Chaldee, and he's come into the promised land, coming from Haran up in Syria, down through Damascus. And you'll see on this map and many other maps that we have used in our study and will continue to use these travel routes. And as we've talked about the importance of the land of Canaan, one of the points of emphasis has been not only because it's a part of the Fertile Crescent, not only because it's a part of an area that can be used for agriculture and cattle and various types of things because of the water, but also because of the passage routes or trade routes that go through this land around the Mediterranean Sea. Three of them. The Way of the Sea, which when we come to Megiddo, it branches off and goes up to Damascus, or you can follow the coastal line. Or the Way of Shur that goes up over the mountainous ranges of the hill country, as it was called, the Way of Shur, up through Bethlehem and Jerusalem and up to Shechem, and then crossing over the Jordan River, it picks up here the King's Highway that runs on the Transjordan side of the Jordan River and the Dead Sea. Now, elevation, just a very quick review. Of course, here we have sea level as we go up to the city of Jerusalem. What's the approximate elevation of the city of Jerusalem? About 23, 25, thereabouts, depending upon what source you're reading from, 100 feet. Now, when you go from Jerusalem down into the Jordan River Valley, you see the surface of the Dead Sea at minus 1,292 feet below sea level. Look at that carefully. So we go up to Jerusalem, and then we've got a pretty dramatic drop in elevation down to the Jordan River Valley. And then when you come up out of the Jordan River Valley to Mount Nebo, where Moses stood on the mount and saw the promised land, not being allowed to go in, of course, what was the approximate elevation of Mount Nebo? Let me rephrase that. What was the approximate elevation of Mount Nebo? A little further, about 3,000. About 3,000. Now, the thing that makes that interesting is when you've got Jerusalem over here, Jenny, at an elevation of about 23 or 25, thereabouts, 100 feet, and then you've got Mount Nebo over here, you would expect it to be higher And why? What was it Moses saw from here? He could see all the land. He could even see the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. Now, if Jerusalem was higher than Mount Nebo, he couldn't do that. Now, when we go up here to the north, to Mount Hermon, what's the approximate elevation of Mount Hermon? About 9,000 feet, thereabouts. All right? When we come down, you see, we're getting back closer here to sea level when we begin to examine the north and south borders of the land. Now, I said all that so that you would see we've got elevation coming up to here, sharp drop-off down into the Jordan River Valley, quite a dramatic elevation climb up to Mount Nebo, and then when you get over here to the Arabian Desert, you're at a higher plain, but vastly arid, and of course we've got the lava beds in between here, so that presents great problems as far as travel is concerned as well. Now, when we consider Abraham's travels coming from Ur of Chaldee over to Haran and then dropping down to Damascus and then over into Shechem, how far has he traveled? Oh, come on. Go ahead. Yes? Well, I've not read of any bridges. What I have read historically along these trade routes, there were fords, and they had to be carefully selected and well defended because I don't recall if you remember, let me rephrase that. You may or may not remember, as we talked about these rivers, the Yarmuk and the Jabbok and the Arnon and the Zered, we saw some pictures, modern day pictures, of where these rivers are. And we're not talking about during normal season a wide expanse like the Mississippi or the Ohio. We're talking about something that might be a dribble, but something you could walk through, with one exception, cliffs on the sides. So when you're talking about north and south places to cross the river, you would have to select. You might have to go out of your way. In other words, what I'm trying to say, and not very effectively, is these fords were generally known to be here or here or here. You couldn't just say, well, I think there's the river, I believe I'll go across. You had to be selective as to where. Yeah. Yeah, you'd have to have a place where you could access the river to get across it. And, of course, the King's Highway, I've never traveled that, never been in that part of the world, but I think it would be neat to take a look. You might be able to do that with Google Earth. Richard's kind of gotten me hooked on that a little bit. And see if you can zoom in on some of these places and actually see some of the fords along these rivers. But that's one of the things that causes me to think that this is the likely way that Abraham came to Shechem. Of course, we have no proof of that. It's just a certain surmising, but it's very likely that he used this popular trade route to come down and then come over, or else come over here and come down. One of the two would satisfy, I think, the circumstances better than coming this way, although that is a possibility. Okay? Now, having said all that, you see where we are. But we know that the map shows us that Abraham has traveled a long, long way to get to Shechem. How far has he traveled? Long, long way. You guys are so helpful. A long, long way. Well, we know that he left, and we know that he came to Haran, and we know that from Haran to Ur is about 600 miles. Now, how long he was in Haran, you consider that homework and see if you can get any information on that. But we do know that he came on down to Shechem, and it's about 400 miles from Haran to Shechem. Now, I'm not the mathematic major in the family, but I understand that to be pretty close to 1,000 miles. How'd you like to travel that without air-conditioned automobile or train or airplane? 1,000 miles going where you didn't know where because God said go. Very much. But I want you to keep in mind, however, that these trade routes, though from our perspective might not be the most accessible way to travel, we're talking about highways in ancient times. And to travel along a highway, there are some things that you just really need to have, especially if you're traveling like Abraham was with herds and flocks. Water, vegetation. And this proposed route follows the Euphrates River. And looking on our Google Earth map, we know that along the Euphrates River, there was lush green, there was water and plants and vegetation for the animals and that sort of thing. And of course, we know that when he travels down from Haran to Shechem, who's traveling with him? Lot and all of his herds and flocks and so forth, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But there has to be enough lush and green, and thus we see the fertile crescent, as we've talked about, to sustain one in such a travel with flocks and herds, and whatever people went along to manage all of that. Any questions or comments just here? Go into a land that I will show thee. Now, the importance of this land, I don't want that. Let's go away. I want you to see this. In Genesis chapter 12, 1, 2, and 3, where we just read, I want you to remember these three promises: the nation, land, and seed. That's the order in which they are fulfilled. And so we're going to be studying them in that order: the nation, land, and the seed promise. Of course, the seed promise coming from Genesis 3, verse 15, where the seed of woman would bruise the head of the serpent, the first promise of redemption. Now, just a mental note here. We're not going to Genesis 17 just yet, but we don't often refer to Abram as Abram. We always call him Abraham. And we know in Genesis chapter 17 and in verse 5, his name was changed from Abram to Abraham. But when we're back in our text of Genesis chapter 12, we see him referred to as Abram. And so we're going to pursue that just a little bit. These texts you're going to be looking at quite a little bit as our study develops further. Genesis 12, Genesis 22, and Hebrews 11. In fact, I want you to remember those so badly, you might like to write those down in your list of passages to remember, because it's quite probable that you will see these or be asked about these in days to come. Now, on this particular chart, the land, the nation, the seed promise becomes the focus. But when Abraham comes into the land, we've got a problem. There are people that are there. Now, why does that present a problem? God said, I'm going to give you this land. Fine. I come down to the land and there are people already living there. Now, granted, the land was not as populated as L.A., but there are people that are living there. Now, what problem would that present for Abraham? Well, they probably don't want to leave where they are. I want you to look at verse 6 of Genesis chapter 12, or chapter 10, I'm sorry. Verse 6 of Genesis chapter 10. It tells us there in verse 6 of Genesis chapter 10 that one of Ham's son, named Canaan, we've talked about that, is the man who settled in this portion of the land that was promised unto Abraham. Dropping down in chapter 10 to verse 15 through verse 19, we see identified Canaan and his descendants living in this particular land. But as you turn the page over to the 15th chapter, Abraham comes into the land, and beginning in verse 13, look at it there carefully. I'm sorry, look at verse 8 first, and then we'll look at verse 13. Verse 8. And he said, O Lord Jehovah, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? Now, that would seem to be a legitimate question, wouldn't it? If you arrive in a place and you find that there are people already there, it'd be a lot easier for you to just pile up your pile of rocks and lay claim to that land if somebody else hadn't already done that. But the Amorites are in the land. In fact, if you'll read down in verse 13 now, beginning chapter 15, beginning at verse 13. And he said unto Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be sojourners in the land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. But thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace, thou shalt be buried in a good old age, and in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. Now wait just a minute. The Canaanites, what people have they now become? All right, they're encompassing basically the same people, the same descendants as it were. Now, when the Amorites are in the land, God said they're going to go, but here's the problem. They're not as bad as they're going to get. The time for them to go is not yet. They're going to get worse. Now, it's going to take 400 years for that to be accomplished. 400 years. Now, in the interim, when God tells Abraham that I'm going to make of you a great nation and I'm going to give them this land, you see why that would present all kinds of problems to Abraham? 400 years in the fourth generation. Wait, I don't have any children. Would that present you a problem? And when the promise was initially made to Abraham, how old was he? 75 years old. How old was he about so when the child was born? 100 years old. Now, that's a long time to wait to be having children. I am 57. My dad was about 55 when I was born. In other words, at 57, my dad had a 2-year-old. Any of you want to start out that way? Now, here's Abraham. An old man. And now he finds out it's going to be 400 years down the pike before he's going to receive the land. And the reason is the Amorites are in the land and they're not as bad as they're going to get. Now note that they worshipped the gods of fertility, Baal, and his female counterpart, Ashtoreth, as some pronounce it. And these would be driven out. Look, if you will, now beginning at verse 17 of our text, Genesis chapter 15, verse 17. And it came to pass that when the sun went down, and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a flaming torch that passed between these pieces. In that day, Jehovah made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. Now, David, in reference to the question you asked me about the relationship between the Canaanites and the Amorites, thank you, the Amorites, you'll note on the chart on page 39 of your lesson book that from the Canaanites, descendants of Ham, it would appear that we have several groups of people that have descended. Sidon, Heth, or the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, and the Hivites, coming from the Canaanites. So we've got, I guess you would call it some overlap in descent here among these who descended from the Canaanites. Of course, you'll notice also on that chart, you've got the Ethiopians, the Egyptians, the Libyans, and then the southern Arabs, the early Babylonians in the area there where Nimrod settled in the plain of Shinar, and then the Philistines that eventually came down into this area from the Isle of Crete, I believe. Or is it Cyprus? Crete, I believe, is where the Philistines came from, into the land that we typically identify as the land of Canaan, where some of these were. But now you see what a perplexing circumstance it would be for Abraham. Yes. That's okay. Uh-huh. Did, yes. Well, Corinth is, of course, predominantly made up of Gentiles down in a different part of the world, actually. When we get a map. Okay, okay. But yes. Not the same God, I don't believe. No, Aphrodite was a goddess of fertility called Venus by... Help me out here, Kateri. I sometimes get that turned around. We've got Aphrodite is the Greek name or the Roman name? The Greek name. And then Venus would be the Roman name. Okay, sometimes I get that turned around. But that represented the same goddess. Ashtoreth, sometimes called Ashtoreth, was a goddess of fertility, along with the male counterpart Baal. But going back much farther back in time, to the time of Abraham and some of these ancients. Now, you might just simply go online and do a search and find where the origin of some of these gods and goddesses, where that began. Yeah, but not the same as what was worshipped in Corinth. But you know what, interesting, just another thought on that. It's interesting that you would bring that up. And when we think of even the people of God in ancient times as well as New Testament times, when they began to worship idols, it seems to always involve those things that are part of the base desires of man. What did you say, Terry? I don't remember. That was an Egyptian god, yes. Baal. Yeah, not Egypt. The golden calf, when the children of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt and worshipped the golden calf, it was because that was where their roots were, where they originated their familiarity with worshiping cows. And, of course, you see when they came over to Mount Sinai, that was a problem. When Aaron is called upon to make us gods that can go before us, he built a golden calf because that's what they were familiar with back in Egypt. No. Yeah. No, they're different, but six, one half dozen the other when you talk about idolatry. David. Well, that's right, and that's what we see in Deuteronomy 17 when they were instructed not to do that. Deuteronomy 7, it is. The kings in Deuteronomy 17 were instructed not to do that. But the reason was their hearts would be turned. And, of course, that's exactly what we see with Solomon and how that he began to erect the high places to worship the idols of the women that he had married to satisfy them. And even Solomon, at points in his life, was guilty of worshiping these idols. Yeah, excellent. Okay, so this was a problem with the Canaanites and those who dwelt in the land. Abraham's wealth. I know that you talked about that some last time with Richard, but his wealth consisted largely of cattle and sheep. We talked about that the last class that I was here, how that when he left Ur of Chaldee, he took some of the things, the possessions that he had along the way. Now, with cattle and sheep, as we've alluded to already, you need water, you need a place to feed these animals. And so, typically, what does a shepherd do? We've noted that from the Hebrew letter in the 11th chapter that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob dwelt in tents, as in a land not their own. They were sojourners. Now, Carolyn, we talked about living in a tent. What does that indicate? All right, what would a shepherd do? Now, we see that in the valley here. When you look out in the fields and you see a bunch of sheep, what do you, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but what do you then look for? You'll see a little trailer. Yeah. All right, and that's not, as far as the relationship between cattle and sheep, that was one of the objections that cattlemen had to sheep herders, was the sheep would eat the grass down to the roots and then move somewhere else, and there wasn't grass for the cattle. Cattle don't do that generally. Eat it right down to they pull out the roots. But Abraham, he would move up and down the land because of the needs that he had for his flocks and his herds. Now, I want to show you, we may not get to do it tonight, but I've got a map I want to show you of the numerous travels of Abraham. We're going to see it a little bit with these bubbles on these maps. But note that he came into the land and settled in Shechem originally. If you'll turn in your Bible to Genesis chapter 12 once again. Genesis chapter 12. And in verse 6. It says, and Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem, unto the oak of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And Jehovah appeared unto Abram and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto Jehovah, who appeared unto him, and he removed from thence unto the mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Ai on the east, and there builded an altar unto Jehovah and called upon the name of Jehovah. Now you see on this map where Bethel is. Shechem is right here. He's traveled just a little bit south and, of course, still in the hill country of the land. And then he moves farther south, camping on the edge of Negev. Now we said the edge of Negev. What is Negev? Desert, that's right, very arid. Now, camping on the edge of this part of the country would tell us that there were pastures there for his livestock. There was obviously some water that was there for his livestock. But look, if you will, in verse 9, it says, and Abram journeyed going on still toward the south, or Negev, and then in verse 10, and there was a famine in the land. And Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was sore in the land. Now, that introduces us to some things that we're going to talk about, though not in great detail. But why did Abram, or Abraham, as we commonly refer to him, why did he go Egypt? Famine. All right, you've got all these flocks and all these herds and all the people that are necessary to sustain all of that. And who's traveling with him? Lot's traveling with him at this point. And Lot's flocks and herds are multiplying. And now with a famine, what are you going to feed all of this? What are they going to drink? What is to be had in Egypt? The Nile River, yes. And all of its lush that it can provide. The life of Egypt. Now, the Nile River was big. It supplied the water necessary for Lot and for Abram. So they go down into Egypt. Now, Abraham's got a problem. What's his problem in the latter portion of the 12th chapter? He's got a wife. Well, just having a wife might turn into a problem, but he has a very beautiful wife, all right? He has a very beautiful wife. And what problem does he recognize that might present down in Egypt? They might kill him. That's right. Take everything he's got, including his wife. So at this point, his wife, Sarai, travels with him as his sister. Now, when that news is learned, does it create a problem? Big time. Look at verse 17. And Jehovah plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abraham's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram, rather, and said, "What is this that thou hast done unto me? Why didst thou not tell me that she was thy wife? Why saidest thou, she is my sister, so that I took her to be my wife? Now therefore, behold thy wife, take her and go thy way." And Pharaoh gave men charge concerning him, and they brought him on the way, and his wife, and all that he had. Now, I want to ask you a question. When we see the relationship that Pharaoh is tempted to partake of with Sarah, or Sarai, how did Pharaoh know that this was a bad thing? Plagues. Who brought those plagues upon Pharaoh? And did Pharaoh know why? Apparently he figured it out. Yes, he did. Well, now wait just a minute. What was the big deal of Pharaoh taking another man's wife? Well, it's done all the time today, isn't it? How did Pharaoh know that? You mean God communicated that to him? Isn't that interesting? Is that right? Yes. Pharaoh was under law. Law governing another man's wife. Isn't that interesting? Yes, isn't that interesting? Yes. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? If the plagues came first, yeah. Yeah, but he's got a good handle on that now, don't he? He understands that. And we're going to see a little bit later regarding Isaac's wife, Rebekah, with a man named Abimelech, that Isaac did the same thing with Rebekah, and Abimelech understood, it's wrong for me to take another man's wife. Can't have Rebekah. Now, all of that, I just wanted to emphasize this simple point, that here are men who were not necessarily identified as men of God, but they were told what God said about a man and his wife. Just an interesting observation, I believe. They knew that this was wrong. They were under law. Now, having said all of that, when they are thrown out of Egypt, where do they go back? They go back to Bethel. Place where they were. Pick up your Bible again and begin reading in chapter 13, verse 1. It said, "And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot with him into the south." Where did he go? All right. It says, "And Abram was very rich in cattle and silver and in gold, and went on his journeys from the south, even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, where he'd made the altar to begin with." So he's right back up here at the same place. Now, having traveled down into Negev and on into Egypt because of the famine, now he's come back. How far was it? From Negev down into Egypt was about 200 miles. So he's gone about 200 miles. I don't know how long he was in Egypt, but now he's come back well over 200 miles. Now, I don't know how much walking you folks do, but Abraham has traveled from Ur of Chaldee up to Haran, which is how far? 600 miles, then down to Shechem, which is How far? 400 miles. And then he's gone from Shechem down to Bethel, down to Negev, down to Egypt, and then back to Bethel. He's kind of old. Yeah. Getting older by the mile, yeah. But he's evidently in pretty good shape. So he's traveling right along. All right. Abraham and Lot traveling together. And as we continue to read in the text, turn the page into chapter 13 a little bit farther. With all these riches that Abram and Lot have, there begins to develop strife between their herdsmen. Yes. I would assume so. I understand that on a good day, traveling without herds and flocks, you might be able to make 20 miles. But with herds and flocks, you're just kind of meandering. And of course, too, you have to consider terrain and all of that sort of thing, elevation. Coming from Egypt back to Bethel. He's coming from low country up to some higher country and then down into some low and then back up to in the neighborhood of over 2,000 feet elevation in the hill country. So, with all these flocks and herds, quite a journey. David? Yes. Yes. Exactly. And we see all this geography. This factors into all of it. The travels of Abraham, all this distance, are to fulfill a promise that God made regarding our salvation through the seed of Abraham. Excellent. Now, as we think about Abraham and Lot and the trouble that existed between them, pick up the reading, if you will, please, beginning in about verse 9. We see that there's strife, verse 8. Abram says, "Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdsmen and thy herdsmen, for we are brethren." Lots of lessons can be preached from that. But he said, "Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. If thou wilt take the right hand, then I will go to the left." And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before Jehovah destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of Jehovah, like the land of Egypt, as thou goest unto Zoar. Now, land changes somewhat, does it not, over time? And certainly God can affect some of those changes, as we want to see on this map. Look, if you will, where are they? All right, up here. And Abram says, "You look where you want to look, and you take what you want to take, and I'll go the other way." And what was it that Lot saw? The watered plains. Now look. What did he see? The watered plains. Where? The Jordan River Valley. But when we look at this area where we know that Lot eventually wound up, what is it now? And what was it in New Testament times? In fact, what was it after the text tells us here in verse 10, before Jehovah destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of Jehovah, like the land of Egypt, as thou goest unto Zoar? This land is described as very lush, well-watered plains. That's what Lot saw. And he went there. And it tells us that he moved his tent in verse 12 as far as Sodom. Now, we talked briefly in our last study about where Sodom and Gomorrah are located. We don't know. But we do know that when Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed, that when Lot came up out of the wicked city, he wanted to go to Zoar. Which tells us that as he looked and saw the well-watered plains of the Jordan, and he settled in Sodom and Gomorrah near to Zoar. This statement that's made here, that it was well, of Egypt, as thou goest unto Zoar. Well, what happened after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah? What I'm saying is that something changed. When Lot went into this area, it was seen as well-watered plains. And it's specified here that it was before God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. What did God use to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? Fire and brimstone. We want to read about that in just a little bit when we get over to the 18th chapter or 19th chapter. In fact, you might just want to turn over there now, looking at the clock. As you look at Genesis chapter 19, God is going to destroy these wicked places and those that inhabit them. And Lot is instructed to get out. He's instructed to take his family. But as he came to his sons-in-laws, what did they do? Chapter 19, verse 14. They did what? They mocked him. When you look at verse 15, when the morning arose, then the angels hasted Lot, saying, "Arise and take thy wife and thy two daughters that are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city." Look at verse 16. But he lingered. How did Lot get out of the city with his life? Dragged out. Leaving the city was, or in good shape, I should say, was conditioned, don't look back. And of course, we're well familiar with what Lot's wife did. She looked back and she became, verse 26, a pillar of salt. And Jesus references that in Luke chapter 17 and verse 23, or rather verse 32, by simply saying, remember Lot's wife. But if you look at verse 23 of this chapter, chapter 19, verse 23, it says, "The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot came unto Zoar. Then Jehovah rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from Jehovah out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities, and that which grew upon the ground." You see a change that's taken place in this land? God did something to it. Before, it was lush, well-watered. This is what Lot saw. But after the fire and brimstone, what was it? It was nothing. It was desert. And I guess we might even say worse than desert. When you look at desert, it might grow something. But you know, interestingly enough, no one today knows where Sodom and Gomorrah, where they are located. But scholars suggest that they are down in this area, somewhere near Zoar, because Lot had time to travel to Zoar, and then fire and brimstone fell upon Sodom and Gomorrah. And obviously there's a change that took place in that part of the country after God destroyed it. Scholars tell us that they believe that Sodom and Gomorrah might be down here in the southern tip of what is now the Dead Sea. But if you'll go on Google Earth and zoom in on this, you'll find that there are currently salt mines that are there. And of course, one of the things that we do know is that over a period of time, we find mineral deposits that build up over a lengthy period of time, and certainly we can see evidence of that here. There are other illustrations that we could offer of that, but that's being mined out of the southern end of the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea area currently. Any questions or comments just here? I want to leave that portion then and go back just a little bit in Genesis to pick up another thought or two perhaps before our time expires. When Lot chose the well-watered plains of Sodom and Gomorrah, it's interesting to note that when he began in the plains, it wasn't very long until he's in the city. And there's the danger, of course, of moving our tent as far as or in the direction of a particular wicked place like we see here. There's always danger. But be that as it may, I noted Genesis. Well, I've already passed that, so I'll just click that one more time. One more time. All right, here we go. Abraham moved south to the place called Oaks of Mamre. Where did he come from? Well, when Lot chooses down here, Abram or Abraham, he settles then with his flocks and herds here. Yes. All right. That's right. They had law. And, of course, at this point, we know what they were violating. We'll have occasion to talk about that more, I guess, another time as we talk about what they did. I want you to, on your map, study very carefully through the next several chapters of Genesis, the travels of Abraham. We're going to treat the travels of Isaac, the travels of Jacob, and the travels of Joseph in a similar fashion. So as you continue studying through the book of Genesis, you want to look for these things. Note the names of the places, the events that happened there, and that will be the substance of our study. Okay?